This is an AMI podcast.
Keep the conversation going off the air. Your voice matters. Email feedback at AMI.ca or connect with us on Twitter at AMI Audio and let us know what you think about our programming.
This is Description Deep Dive, the James Bond Files, where we explore the visual world of 007. Here, we flesh out the characters, test drive the cars, play with the gadgets, and trek to the exotic locations from all 25 official Bond films. I'm your describer and host, JJ Hunt. Welcome.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
This is the final episode of the James Bond Files, so we need to talk about Daniel Craig, the current James Bond. Craig stars in Casino Royale, released in 2006, Quantum of Solace from 2008, Skyfall from 2012, 2015's Spectre, and finally, No Time to Die, which was scheduled for release in 2020, but has now been pushed to 2021. In Episode 3, we talked about Dalton and Brosnan's turns as 007 and how the producers had modernized the franchise with more grounded plots, some intrigue at MI6, and an intentional effort to create even bigger action sequences. Brosnan's last film, Die Another Day, released in 2002, was hugely profitable, earning $432 million U.S. worldwide, plus another $70 million from product placement deals with some 20 partner companies. Despite the big box office numbers, the film wasn't well reviewed by critics or fans, and it looked like a bit of a dinosaur next to another 2002 release, The Bourne Identity, starring Matt Damon. Bond producers saw the writing on the wall and decided to reboot their series, building on the work that Dalton and Brosnan had done to modernize and adding new cinematic techniques borrowed from Bourne. The plan was simple but extreme. They would take James Bond back to the beginning, before he earned his 00 status, and regrow the character from scratch. He would be a lean, mean spy who uncovers plots, assassinates enemies, and fights his way out of world-altering predicaments with his fists, his charm, and ambiguous morals, all filmed with a new sense of style and cinematic urgency, which we'll talk about in a bit. Hiring a new Bond was an important part of the reboot. With fans of the series eager to have their say, and this newfangled internet giving everyone a platform from which to pontificate, rant, and harangue, the search for a new Bond became downright political. Some advocated for another tall, dark, and handsome, charming, and athletic Brit in the mold of Connery or Brosnan. Clive Owen was the odds-on favorite from that camp. Some thought that it was time to shake things up a bit with a black James Bond. Idris Elba is an actor whose name is perpetually on the Bond shortlist. Some wanted a woman to take over as 007, but given that Bond producers had tried and failed to get a female 00 spin-off movie made, starring either Michelle Yeoh or Halle Berry, both box office draws in their own right, Bond was highly unlikely to be recast as a woman. In the end, the producers went with an actor that hardly broke the mold, and yet was still seen as a radical departure by more rabid protesting traditionalists. They chose blonde-haired, blue-eyed, 5'10", Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig is a bulldog of a man, a former semi-pro rugby player who's hotter than he is handsome. He wears his sandy blonde hair short, but often unkempt, and has light blonde eyebrows that almost disappear on his fairly heavy brow. His blue eyes are small and rather close together. His nose is solid, some might say large, and his lips are somewhat thin. His face is lean, which exaggerates the defined and taut muscles in his jaw and under his cheekbones. He's a good-looking man, but it's perhaps despite his features not necessarily because of them. Now, let's cut to the chase. Daniel Craig is buff. He has a thick, muscular, hairless chest, bulging shoulder muscles, arms with beefy biceps, and abs that look like they were earned in the field, not in the gym. In previous films, the producers had used any excuse to show Bond girls at the beach or in a pool. But now, Bond himself is the eye candy, rising out of the surf at every opportunity, to the delight of an admiring audience. With Casino Royale being an origin story of sorts, it made sense to rethink the supporting characters too. And the producers made some interesting choices. They decided to keep Judi Dench as M, at least in the near term. I suppose one could be irked by this ripple in the Bond space-time continuum, but come on, it's Dame Judi Dench! For a lot of us, she's peak M. Then they left both Moneypenny and Q out of the first two films, although Moneypenny does get name-dropped when Bond meets Vesper Lynd. Q was pushed aside to curb the reliance on the increasingly goofy gadgets, which is why he was left out of Moore's first film, too. By 2012's Skyfall, fans were eager to meet the new quartermaster, a young computer security expert played by Ben Whishaw. A slight white man with a mop of dark brown hair, old-fashioned half-rimmed glasses, and British schoolboy good looks, Whishaw was cast not only for his considerable acting chops, but for his youthful, bookish appearance. When you sit him down beside Craig, Bond looks like a grizzled field agent, despite only being two films old. They brought Miss Moneypenny back in Skyfall 2, but in this iteration of the character, she gets to be a proper field agent. And her flirting with Bond has some weight because their hookup is dangled as a genuine possibility. Naomi Harris, a young black Brit from London, plays the role with strength and charm. She's lean and slight and has round cheeks, large brown eyes, natural curly hair, and muscular arms. CIA agent and friend of MI6, Felix Leiter, is a character that's been in the franchise since the very beginning. In seven outings between 1962 and 1987, the role was played by six different actors. But in the Casino Royale reboot, the producers decided to hire a new actor and stick with him for a while. Jeffrey Wright, known for his deep, gravelly voice, is a round-faced black man with a receding hairline and a full but trimmed beard. Wright appeared in both Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, and according to the trailers, he'll be in No Time to Die, too. In Skyfall, a new key character arrives on the scene and throws a wrench into the British intelligence service, Gareth Mallory, the chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, played by esteemed actor Ralph Fiennes. Fiennes is a thin, middle-aged white man with receding light brown hair, blue eyes, and a long nose. According to the IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, he's a full inch taller than Daniel Craig, but you wouldn't necessarily know it based on the height-altering camera angles they use in some of their shared scenes. Every Bond needs villains, and for Craig, they created some beauties. In Casino Royale, Bond's poker-playing nemesis, known as Le Chiffre, is played by the wonderfully sinister Mads Mikkelsen, a thin white man with a small chin, full lips, short hair with a strangely disquieting side part, and a scarred, milky eye that weeps tears of blood. In Skyfall, Javier Bardem plays Raul Silva, a maniacal mastermind who's part Hannibal Lecter, part syndicate crime boss. As Silva, Bardem, who's Spanish, has golden dyed blonde hair and eyebrows, which creates an intriguing look that draws attention to his well-crafted, off-kilter persona. He has large, shallow-set eyes with heavy lids, a long, wide nose, and exaggerated full lips. When we first meet the dapper villain, he's dressed in a cream silk jacket, olive-green waistcoat, and flashy dress shirt with a tan tile pattern. Bardem is no stranger to villains, having earned a spot in the Psycho Hall of Fame with his portrayal of unstoppable evil Anton Chigurh in the Coen Brothers adaptation of the Cormac McCarthy novel No Country for Old Men. And of course, in Spectre, Bond fans were delighted by the return of the world's greatest supervillain, Ernst Stavros Blofeld. Without dropping any spoilers, which I have to say is much harder when discussing the Craig films, I can tell you that Blofeld is played by the incomparable Christoph Waltz, a small white man with short silver blonde hair and an eerie confidence and charm that's conveyed brilliantly with a subtle, impish, and wicked smirk. In a nod to the original evil genius, Waltz is costumed in dark, open Nehru jackets with short, unfolded stand-up collars. This places him on the fashion show runway right between the original Blofeld in his tan Mao suits and Dr. Evil in his steel-gray Nehru jackets. Let's get back to the need for this reboot. In 2002, the Bond franchise was still raking in the money, but it wasn't exactly cutting-edge filmmaking. The special effects were liberally used, but were often pretty weak, and the gadgets had become goofy again. And despite more contemporary plot structures and character development, the films were following action movie trends, not leading them. This was made startlingly clear by the release of The Bourne Identity, which revolutionized the genre. Director Doug Liman, along with his cinematographer and editor, took the intensified continuity techniques that we discussed back in episode 1 and supercharged them. And every action movie since has followed in their footsteps. Filmmakers usually lay out scenes so that the visuals let the story unfold in a logical linear path, and audio description reflects that. The classic example is a car pulling up to a house. In the earlier movies, Bond would be filmed in a wide shot, approaching the Aston Martin, then getting into the car and driving away. There might be some shots of the car driving along a series of roads, then approaching a house and pulling to the curb. Bond is shown getting out of the car, walking up to the house, and knocking on the door. All of that might take 30 to 45 seconds. But with intensified continuity, you cut out all of the extraneous visuals and present the audience with a pared-down version that gives just enough visual information to get you from A to B. With the Bourne movies, Liman and company took this to the extreme. A quick shot of the car, close-up of a hand opening the door, car shifting into gear, car turning hard, close-up of tires screeching to a halt. Car door opens. Close-up of hand knocking on door. Total time? Maybe 6 seconds. When you apply this technique to action or fight scenes, as they did in Bourne and then in the Bond reboot, the results are staggering. Instead of packing the scene with wide shots of a moderate length that help us place the combatants in their environment, anticipate each punch and kick, and track the fight in a considered manner, we're now shown half-second close-ups of elbows connecting with chins, blades swiping at torsos, and knees buckling under stomping boots. These shots aren't presented in a montage, this is still linear storytelling, but the visual narrative is pared down in the extreme. More edits means shorter shots, so this phenomenon is often measured in average shot length. Back in episode 1, I mentioned that the average shot length of a Hollywood movie in the 1950s was 9 seconds. And by the early 1970s, it had dropped to about 5.5 seconds. When Bond was rebooted in the early 2000s, the average shot in an action movie was just over 2 seconds long. And to add to the chaos, the cinematographers use handheld cameras, making the visuals shaky and streaked with action blur. The close-ups, the quick edits, and the shaky camera work all combine to create a new movie-going experience. Sighted audiences are no longer taking in these scenes intellectually. The pace is too quick. We're processing subconsciously. We're feeling the action and responding emotionally. This is a huge challenge for audio description writers and narrators. When the pacing is relaxed, the action unfolds smoothly, and we have more time to describe it. Ramp up the pace and throw dozens of quick images at us, and we need to adjust so that you can follow the narrative and appreciate the energy. When you're watching the described films from the Bond reboot, listen closely in those action scenes. The description writers will carefully select the key visuals and string them together to create a cohesive thread. And the narrator will place each described action and important prop or set piece with their voice, while conveying the urgency with the quality of their read. Everyone involved in the description process, the writers, the narrators, the engineers, and producers, they all have to bring their A-games to modern action scenes. The early films in the James Bond franchise not only established the characters and tropes that have kept the series unified, but they did so with a clear sense of style. And while elements of the original designs were used in the films of Moore, Dalton, and Brosnan, none of their movies were particularly stylish. But with the Daniel Craig reboot, the filmmakers went all in on style, creating a distinctive aesthetic that evokes the Connery era while still being cutting-edge contemporary. Now, I want to take a moment to say a word about Sean Connery. Today, as I'm standing at the microphone, the world is learning of Connery's passing. While I can't say I agree with all of the man's opinions, as a movie fan, I have a profound appreciation for his contribution to popular film. The Untouchables, Time Bandits, The Hunt for Red October, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and of course, James Bond. It's a remarkable film legacy. Sean Connery, 1930 to 2020. Now, back to style in the Daniel Craig reboot. To begin with, the filmmakers decided on a color palette for the series. Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, and Spectre are all filmed with muted, earthy colors. Silver grays, golden browns, olive greens, steel blues, and warm creams. These colors are picked up in the vehicles, the clothing, the locations, the lighting, and the set pieces. In Casino Royale, the private poker room has goldenrod carpeting, cream-colored tablecloths, and desert brown walls and detailing. In Venice, dressed in a simple gray t-shirt, Bond pilots a mahogany sailboat with a cream-colored hull down a muted teal-blue canal lined with Renaissance buildings in terracotta red, tan, and dusty rose. In Quantum of Solace, Bond flies an old-fashioned steel propeller plane over a sandy desert into a rocky valley dotted with olive-green scrub brush. In Skyfall, we enter MI6's new underground digs, a labyrinth of brick and stone tunnels lit with dim golden-yellow lights, which lead to a cavernous room of gray brick pillars supporting concrete arches. Then later, in Macau, Bond takes us to an exclusive casino decorated with intricate teak room dividers and golden lions, dimly lit in warm yellow light. And finally, he drives the original Silver Birch DB5 into the misty moors of Scotland, a landscape awash in earthy greens, browns, and grays. The filtered palette and the muted tones remind me of picture postcards from the 1950s. And that leads me to the other callback from the Connery era, the retro late 50s design style. Daniel Craig is often dressed in classic suits taken straight from Connery's era. Slim-fitting cuts, narrow ties, simple pocket squares with clean lines. It's an elegant style that Craig wears very well. And the Bond women are attired in similar fashions. In Casino Royale, Vesper Lynd, played by the classically beautiful Eva Green, dresses to impress in a floor-length cocktail gown the color of blackberry wine, which features a halter-like bodice, a plunging neckline, and a bare back, all of which highlights her lithe frame and delicate features. Inspector, Dr. Madeleine Swan, accompanies Bond on a train trip into the Moroccan desert. In striking dark red lipstick, Swan, played by Léa Seydoux, wears her shoulder-length sandy blonde hair in luxurious curls and a silky silver evening gown with a high empire waistline that is perfectly in keeping with the refined vintage dining car. Eve Moneypenny is costumed in several pencil skirts and dresses that are inspired by mid-century elegance, including a red dress with a button-down top, elbow-length sleeves, and a wide brown belt, a mustard yellow skirt and white blouse with black trim, and a silver blue fitted dress with clean lines and a high neckline. And the overriding style extends to the sets and locations, too. We've already mentioned the Scottish Moors, the various casinos, and the MI6 headquarters, but there's also the Quantum of Solace's mid-century modern desert hotel, the vast palace meeting room used by Spectre, outfitted with a giant boardroom table made of dark polished wood and dimly lit with golden wall sconces, and Blofeld's crater lair, an industrial facility and modernist mansion that is the pinnacle of the retro Bond style. Daniel Craig's Bond films have been massive, even by Bond standards. The sets are huge, the production designs top-notch, and the car chases epic. So it should be no surprise that the budgets are outrageous. Casino Royale cost $150 million. Quantum of Solace and Skyfall cost $200 million apiece. Spectre cost $245 million, and the upcoming No Time to Die has an estimated budget of $250 to $300 million. One of the reasons that the films are so expensive is that the stunts aren't CGI. They're filmed in real life, then augmented with digital visual effects. This makes them more convincing and helps audiences buy into the danger. In Casino Royale, the filmmakers used an air cannon to launch the prototype Aston Martin DB9 into a barrel roll when the car proved too stable to flip with a simple ramp. But the result was more extreme than they had anticipated, and they accidentally rolled the car 7 full times. It's a raw and violent car wreck that inadvertently set the world record for the most barrel rolls in an on-screen car crash. In Spectre, the filmmakers destroyed 7 Aston Martin DB10s at a cost of over $30 million, more than 10% of the film's entire budget. And to end one of Spectre's most impressive action scenes, a record-breaking explosion was executed to perfection. 24 charges, igniting 8,140 liters of kerosene, filmed and presented in a single shot that lasts 15 seconds. Spectre ended with a bang, but its opening sequence was pretty amazing too. The film begins in Mexico City during Day of the Dead celebrations. 1,500 extras were used in the sequence that once again mix live action and digital visual effects. The film starts with a tracking shot, a shot that moves and follows characters as they make their way through a location, or in some cases, a series of locations. They're tricky to film because you have to choreograph everything in advance. The more moving players and props, and the longer it goes on, the trickier it is to film. Spectre's opening tracking shot begins by following a giant skeleton float in a festive Day of the Dead parade, where all of those extras have packed the streets, costumed in black suits, white dresses, and fanciful skeleton makeup. The moving camera finds a couple. She's a beautiful brunette in a purple dress, black corset, and pretty Katrina mask. And he's also masked, wearing a top hat and tails, a black suit adorned with skeleton bones. We follow them fluidly down the street, into a hotel, onto a steel cage elevator, and into a bedroom. They take off their masks, and we learn that it's Bond and his lover we've been following. Bond strips off his costume, revealing a stylish gray suit, and then steps onto the balcony, over the railing and onto the hotel roof with a weapon slung over his shoulder. He strides across neighboring rooftops while the parade continues on the streets below. When he reaches the roof of the building at the end of the block, he kneels behind a half wall and aims his weapon into an apartment across the street. All of this has been one 4-minute-long tracking shot. Well, sort of. In fact, the visual effects crew stitched together 6 different shots filmed in different parts of the city at different times using different types of cameras. But the result is seamless. The action sequence that follows is spectacular, and the Day of the Dead setting is really cool, macabre, and sexy. After the movie came out, tourists began booking flights to Mexico City, eager to take part in the grand parade with its giant puppets, streets full of music, and skeletons in gothic formal wear. The only problem was no such parade existed. The filmmakers had concocted it for the movie. With a huge opportunity about to slip through their fingers, city officials quickly organized an actual parade, modeled on the one in the film. They hired the same designers, the same puppet makers, and even used some of the film's locations for the parade route. I was lucky enough to be in Mexico City for the parade in 2019, and I can tell you that those same floats and puppets from Spectre are now front and center in a parade that draws millions of dapper, devilish partygoers into the streets. I was really hoping that Daniel Craig's final Bond film, No Time to Die, would be released before I wrapped up this podcast. I mean, I was also hoping to leave my basement without a mask in 2020, but hey, what are you going to do? As of right now, the film has a release date of April 2nd, 2021. Daniel Craig is officially the longest-serving 007, even though he's only been in 4 released Bond movies. He has repeatedly stated that he's ready to step down, and it looks like this time he'll actually do it. So, the search is on for the next James Bond. Every internet influencer, troll, and scroller has an opinion on who it should be. Will Idris Elba finally become the first Black Bond? Will Tom Hardy get the call? Or Superman himself, Henry Cavill? Or how about Charlize Theron or Gillian Anderson of X-Files fame? Personally, I like the idea of mixing things up a bit. I think they should find an out-of-shape, middle-aged Canadian with a deep appreciation for Bond visuals, a crazy COVID beard, and a bit too much time on his hands now that this series is over. I think I know a guy. Description Deep Dive, The James Bond Files, was written, recorded, and produced by me, J.J. Hunt, with production assistance from Sam Robinson. Our theme song is Double Agent by Everett Allman, and my script editor and long-suffering soundboard is the lovely Lois Lindsay. Thanks to AMI's Media Accessibility Services team, as well as Andrew Morris, for their support. The manager of AMI Audio is Andy Frank. This is the last in our James Bond series, but it won't be the end of Description Deep Dive. To stay in the loop, follow along on Twitter, both AMI Audio and me, at HeyHeyDoubleJ. Until the next deep dive, my friends.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.